Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with author Cindy Woodsmall, a preeminent writer of Amish fiction, one of the fastest growing popular literature genres. Susan Lewis looks at skyscrapers and spectacles, the subject of two summertime exhibitions drawn from the Philadelphia Museum of Art's collection of prints, photography and works on paper. And Jason Pfeiffer explores the rich history of the Fulton Opera House in Lancaster, the nation's oldest continuously operating theatre. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Amish communities live a very private, rural lifestyle, with most behavior governed by strict old order rules that have changed little in centuries. Yet the old and otherworldliness of these people, who refer to themselves as plain folk, has sparked a new niche in popular literature. Amish fiction has evolved from being a subgenre of Christian fiction into a mass market phenomenon. The books, typically family sagas and tales of romance, are short on sex and violence and long on dramatic tension, often the struggles between good and evil and the threat of the influence of outsiders, the Englishers, on these closed communities. World attention was focused on the Amish in October 2006 when a gunman killed five Amish schoolgirls at the West Nickel Mines School, a one-room schoolhouse in Lancaster County. The emphasis on forgiveness, given much media attention at the time, spurred a wave of interest in the Amish, and thus in books telling their stories. With sales now in the hundreds of millions of dollars, Bonnet Books, as they're affectionately known by readers, are rubbing shoulders with traditional big sellers like sci-fi and crime thrillers. Cindy Woodsmall is one of Amish fiction's foremost authors. Growing up, one of her best friends was Amish Mennonite, and a further adult friendship gave her an introduction to a group of Old Order Amish who agreed to mentor her on the old ways. Two of her first three books in the Sister of the Quilt trilogy made the New York Times bestseller lists. Her latest novel, The Hope of Refuge, came out earlier this month, and she came into our studios earlier this week. Cindy, you're currently on a book tour and have come through a couple of Amish areas, if we can refer to them like that. Did any Amish people show up at any of the book signings?
We have had a couple show up so far.
And what's been the reaction?
Among the Amish people, I think there's been a lot of warmness and favor. A lot of the readers enjoy reading things that take them back to things they've experienced in their own life, like a setting being in your own town. And you're reading it, enjoying parts that the author got correct, and parts are going, oh, it didn't quite work that way. You know, they're just enjoy the romance and the story of it.
You have had two fairly influential Amish people in your life when you were very young and later in adult life. Is that where a lot of the information came from, or did you actually go out and do field research as well?
Well, the seeds to the story of Sisters of the Quilt story was planted when I had an Amish Mennonite best friend growing up. But when it came to writing the story and wanting to add Old Order Amish in, I needed a fresh connection. And so I have stayed in the homes of Old Order Amish and, you know, gotten the opportunity to live like they live for a few days at a time.
And how difficult was that to set up? I mean, is there anything that you do that would be objectionable to the Old Order way of things?
Well, it was a little bit hard to set up in that when I first was wanting to make a connection, I contacted my sister who lives in Pennsylvania, and I said, do you know anyone who knows anyone who might know someone who might, you know, anyone that I could possibly ask a few questions to? And she came back and said, well, I know one lady who has worked for 20 years at a Amish birthing center. And so she contacted her, and that lady knew one Amish lady who might be willing to answer questions through her. So we did that for a year. I asked the woman who had worked at the Amish birthing center questions, and she would take them to the Old Order Amish lady, and I'd give her excerpts, and it would come back to me. It was very slow. At the end of that year, the Old Order Amish woman said, well, just have Cindy come visit me, and we'll sit down and talk about it. So that was the beginning. And I try to be very respectful, and I want to get it accurate so that I'm not treading on thin ice when I write a book. You know, it's solid in its research and in its fairness. The Amish are very humble. They don't mind you saying that they have issues because everybody has issues. It's just that they want it represented in a fair way, and I like doing that.
What surprised you in the course of this research, either over the year of correspondence or in the actual conversations?
I think the most surprising is when I stumble on something when I'm writing, that when my Old Order Amish friends read it, they're like, you still got this inaccurate. And I'm like, oh, I thought I understood this aspect. So that still catches me off guard, or that I will break a rule without realizing it. For example, in The Hope of Refuge, I just had an Old Order Amish woman going to look through homes on a Sunday. Well, for us Englishers, that's normal. I did not realize that that's just not acceptable. We may consider that relaxing and something, you know, I enjoy doing, going through homes on a Sunday. So those type of things still catch me off guard some.
But you did catch that earlier in the story where she hangs her laundry out on the line and realizes that she's broken a rule there, one of the younger characters.
Yeah, I did, but I caught that because of my Old Order Amish readers, and they came back going, you know, she wouldn't have done this and left her laundry on the line on a Sunday. So I had a couple of Sunday issues that I wouldn't have thought about had someone not come back and said, you know, because she did the laundry on the Saturday and she was taking it off the line on the Monday. So it just didn't dawn on me that it shouldn't be left on the line throughout a Sunday.
Tell us a little bit about how these characters were formed. Certainly the male characters have spent time outside of the Amish surroundings.
Right.
Was that purposeful so that you could bring the reader in and have that connection? Or is that something that fundamentally happens? Because you have these few years when young Amish adults, before they commit to the way of life, spend some time out in the wider world, the Rumspringa.
That storyline came through me talking with some younger Amish men, early 20s, and getting an insight into their life. And everyone who leaves isn't necessarily leaving to run around and have a great time. They're leaving to try to get some perspective and try to figure out who they are and what they really want out of life.
And to make a very big decision about their future.
Make a huge decision. And, of course, the fact that the family is all there and all of their support system is inside that community makes it very hard if they're thinking about leaving.
This is a new, a huge now subgenre of literature. How did the stars align? How do you think that we got to a point where there have been books about the Amish for over a century, but this latest huge wave came along seemingly out of nowhere? Can you explain it, and can you tell us how you got involved and how you decided that this would be a genre you would like to write in?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons why so many readers are picking up on it. One is you've got this, it's a last frontier in a way. You've got this hidden culture inside your American culture that has refused to change with the rest of America, and yet they were here in the early 1700s. So we find that part fascinating. It's almost got the science fiction feel in that you have this very historic setting in the middle of all this modern technology. So you've got those readers who are pulling into it. I think a lot of readers may have joined when they saw the school shooting in October of 2006, and the Amish immediately forgave the shooter that day and wanted to make sure that his widow, he had shot and killed five girls and himself. And so they wanted to make sure that his widow was taken care of before they were willing to accept any help from the Englishers who were giving money to try to build a new school or for any doctor's bills, hospital bills, because several were wounded. So I think a lot of people at that moment looked and said, who are these people? And I hear from readers who were out on the West Coast who knew very little, if anything, about the Amish.
Because we did have that huge movie a few years ago. It was surprising that it didn't happen directly after Witness in sort of 89.
And it may have begun there, you know, or a little bit, and it certainly began before the shootings in 06. But that's one thing that made the whole country stop and pause and look and want to understand their lifestyle. And at that point, almost everyone had seen a picturesque view of the Old Order Amish, and they would like to know the story behind the story. And many people have had connections to the Amish in some way. A neighbor or an aunt had a neighbor or a sister, yet you can live right next door to them and not get a view of the life inside and what holds them into their boundaries and what their faith is. So these fiction books that are well-researched give them that opportunity.
And was it these 06 shootings that inspired you to take up pen and paper or keyboard?
No, my first book had actually come out in September of 06.
Right.
So I think what inspired me was just as I was, you know, you get older and you start reflecting on things that happened in your childhood, and the seeds just wanted to grow. And it just became very cathartic for me. I had lost my mother about the time I started writing. So it was just a natural process, and it was going to be a hobby. And every time I wrote, of course, because I had the seeds already planted and I had already connected with an old order Amish friend anew, then it all pieced together to be what I wanted to pursue professionally.
This is also described as a subgenre of Christian fiction. Your books are not in the least bit preachy. If I hadn't been told that, I would never have known.
Thank you.
are there certain rules, though? Are there certain things you won't do in a book? Are there certain plot lines you won't follow? Are there certain characteristics you won't give to one of the characters?
I don't think there's certain plot lines I won't follow. I do think that if I'm going to get into a romantic scene or a violent scene, I will walk you up to that point and then stop, and you know what has taken place without me getting graphic. And I think inspirational fiction, part of the reason it has grown so much, is we do have a lot of leeway to write the story, write the bad characters, write the conflict in there, but just stop before anyone is pulled out of the story because of something graphic.
And the characters are all generally, even the bad guys, are all pretty sympathetic. They all seem like redemption is possible.
So far, I know that there will... my editor has been with me the last couple of days on this book tour, and I have a new character who is not redeeming. And so he just has emotional and psychological issues, and it's very hard to be sympathetic to him because he's going with what he feels, and his destruction path is pretty wide. So, but, you know, most of us, no matter who we are, we can find sympathy for someone if we can get into their life and understand what brought them to that point. And so I like developing the character where you can, next time you see someone who has lied or stolen or something else ungodly, you can say, yes, but what got them to that point? And maybe give them some forgiveness and some leeway in there to not be so judgmental.
These people have lived in relative isolation for the last couple of centuries. What do you think they've kept that would be of value to the rest of this, the rest of our society, do you think? What did you learn from them, or what did you take away from your experiences with them that you felt would improve your own life or indeed improve the lives of people generally?
I think the greatest insight that I've gotten, you know, they have held on to their boundaries. They've put a line down that they've refused to cross over and over and over, many lines. And I think that every one of us, regardless of what our faith is or what we want out of life, know we have to have boundaries or we will destroy our own lives. We can't go with our emotions. We can't always go with our goals. We have to say, this is a line. This is what I'm not going to cross, and not cross it. And they have done that and very successfully held on to generation after generation. You know, 80 to 90% of their children stay within that faith. And when you think about what all that means, what all they have to do without to be able to hold on to that family and faith, it's very impressive.
Cindy Woodsmall. Her latest novel, The Hope of Refuge, is out now on the Waterbrook Press imprint.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Printmaking, photography, and other works on paper have been used to both record and challenge our perceptions of the world. At the Philadelphia Museum of Art this summer, two exhibitions offer views of different surroundings, one focused on city towers, the other on eye-catching gatherings of human beings. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers skyscrapers and spectacles.
In the first half of the 20th century, cities grew not only out, but up. Skyscrapers redefined skylines and became new subjects for artists, who were drawn to these concrete towers, in part because they were new and exciting,
and possibly in part just because it's part of their surroundings.
Curatorial fellow John Vick has selected about 55 works from the museum's collection of prints, photographs, and works on paper. They demonstrate the variety of artistic responses between 1908 and 1941, when the proliferation of skyscrapers dramatically changed the urban landscape. Some pictures document the structures almost like portraits, says Vick, pointing to a 1932 Earl Horder etching of Philadelphia's PSFS building.
It shows the architecture of the building, which was very, very, very revolutionary at the time. The PSFS building is the first skyscraper to embody the principles of the international style that is characterized by asymmetrical plans, open spaces, and most obviously with the PSFS building, an elimination of any sort of decorative work.
The early rise of skyscrapers coincided with New York's Armory Show of 1913, an international show of modern art. Philadelphia Museum of Art curator of prints John Itman says the neo-Gothic style Woolworth Building, represented in several images in this show, became the tallest building in the world when it was completed that same year.
It's interesting how modern that building seemed to artists at that time. It looks a bit dated today in that its format imitated the European Gothic cathedral style, as did many of the early skyscrapers. It's as though they were Gothic cathedrals on steroids.
Artists drew parallels with European cathedrals in ideological as well as visual terms, says John Vick, as skyscrapers were seen as symbols of American values.
If old world Europe was focused on the church financially, but also in terms of ideology, then in modern America, it's enterprise, it's capitalism, it's business. That's the driving force in the country.
Values considered positive by some and dark, even dangerous by others. Vick displays together a set of drawings by Abraham Wolkowitz.
They show skyscrapers rising up from the ground in a single mass that appears rather unstable, crowded. Surrounding these buildings are what look like vultures, and beneath it are hordes of people kind of writhing around.
Below which is a print by Gerald Geerlings, with faint imagery above the Chicago skyline.
You see what the artist pictures as the future city, where skyscrapers are even taller. They're connected by aqueducts, terraces, little bridges between the two. And it's a very visionary, optimistic view of what the new city will look like. It's an architect's dream of sorts.
As skyscrapers became sleeker and more streamlined, some artists used them to explore abstraction, making collages from multiple images, or playing with reflections in photographs shot through glass. The towers became not only subjects themselves, from their heights they also provided new vistas. John Vick and John Itman consider Bernice Abbott's 1932 shot of New York City at night, taken from the Empire State Building, looking down at Herald Square.
And this intersection of streets and skyscrapers and cubistic forms and illumination at night is very inventive in terms of its aesthetics and looks very abstract in its presentation.
The Empire State Building in that picture almost becomes a subject without even being visible, because that picture never would have been possible without it being there.
Indispensable subjects outside the picture frame play an important role in the adjacent exhibition of photographs called Spectacle, where a number of works show people looking at something beyond our view. Curatorial fellow Julia Dolan has gathered photographs that relate in some way to the idea of spectacle, which she says is a broad concept.
The actual definition indicates it's something exhibited to view, something unusual, notable, or entertaining. It can be a funeral. It can be a protest. It can be just a beautiful sight in the natural world. But it doesn't have to be something that we might normally use the word spectacular for.
Themes include man-made or natural sights, as well as people who attract attention. But many shots are of the spectators themselves. As a key image, Dolan points to Leif Friedlander's Mount Rushmore, a shot in which the famous landmark is seen only in its reflection through the glass of the visitor center, where tourists can be seen in random states of interest or disinterest.
They're not necessarily paying attention. They've made this long pilgrimage. Maybe they're tired. Maybe they're bored. Maybe it's not as interesting as they thought it would be.
Some photographs depict spectators at group events, such as a mummer's parade or a funeral during World War II, or a line of people in the Soviet Union waiting to be baptized after the lifting of restrictions on religion. Others capture random moments in time, as in the street shot of a heart attack victim by William Klein.
He's not only photographing the heart attack victim, but he's photographing the spectators. And one of the spectators is eating. Another one over here is smoking a cigarette, and then others are looking at the photographer, not necessarily the incident. So why are they there, and how do they add to the situation? So I think in some ways it's a comment on how we do act as spectators.
Dolan says photography can make the viewer feel like a part of the scene. Vatican No. 2 by Christopher James is taken so close to the people in a crowd that we can only guess from the title, the black garments, and a hand clutching a piece of paper with the word Jesu that we're looking at nuns. Sometimes the photographer himself becomes part of the spectacle, as in Stuart Rome's image of a Haitian festival in which a woman dancing in a trance reaches out to the camera.
And she beckons him to dance with her, and we can see that he has become the spectacle and the spectators surround them. So in some ways it almost makes us feel as if we've become part of the spectacle and are surrounded by spectators.
Drawing us in is presumably the goal of all of these pictures. They suggest that the experience of the moment is made stronger by witnessing the reaction of those who are actually present. They also remind us that we are all spectators, whether watching a parade, gazing at a city skyline, or exploring a gallery of photographs.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. At the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Spectacle runs through September 7th, while Skyscrapers runs through November 1st. The Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia recently celebrated its 200th anniversary, highlighting its distinction as the oldest theatre in the country. However, the Walnut isn't the only theatre in Pennsylvania that stakes a claim in American theatre history. Since its opening in 1852, the doors of the Fulton Opera House in Lancaster County have remained open, making it the oldest continuously operating theatre building in the nation. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now reports, the National Historic Landmark Theatre recently named a new artistic director who aims to preserve the theatre's rich heritage while taking the company into new territory.
The Fulton Opera House sits on a busy street in Lancaster City, just around the corner from the town's main square and a few blocks from City Hall. Built in 1852 as a town meeting hall, it has also always been a theater, a place for live theatrical productions, films, and spectacle. Throughout the last century, the building has undergone many changes, most recently a $9.5 million renovation. But walking into the intricately painted auditorium with its towering proscenium arch, old-fashioned box seats on either side of the stage, and a majestic red curtain, the theater evokes the sense of a bygone era. Over the last decade, longtime freelance director Mark Robin has been at the helm of numerous shows at the Fulton Opera House. When the theater's previous artistic director, Michael Mitchell, died of cancer last September, Robin was tapped to step in as interim artistic director before accepting the position on a permanent basis this January. Robin believes his appointment comes at a pivotal time for the company.
Right now, we're sort of poised to go to whatever that next step is for this theater. For the last 9 years being a guest here, I've sort of watched it go from a largely almost community theater type operation to a quote-unquote legitimate, you know, professional house. And now we have the opportunity to sort of become a major regional theater.
The theater is named for Robert Fulton, an American inventor who developed the first commercially successful steamboat. The Pennsylvania native is a continuing part of the theater's legacy, according to Barry Kornhauser, the Fulton Theater's playwright in residence.
We're coming to the statue of Robert Fulton, the namesake of the theater. It's carved out of one tree trunk, and for over 100 years, the statue stood outside the building. But after a long, long time of cruel winters and crueler pigeons, Robert wasn't doing so well, so they brought him in.
Kornhauser, who's worked at the Fulton for over 25 years and seems to know every chapter of the building's history, explains Fulton Hall, as it was originally known, was constructed on a plot of land where a colonial-era prison once stood, a site known for the 1763 massacre of Conestoga Indians at the hands of vigilantes. When Fulton Hall was designed in the mid-1800s by Philadelphia architect Samuel Sloan, a wall of the prison was left intact to form part of the building's foundation. Tobacco, raw wool, and even manure were stored in the basement of the structure, while the top floor was used as a shooting gallery. From the beginning, the main hall was used as a venue for plays, concerts, lectures, and other forms of entertainment. In the early 1870s, the owner of the hall decided to renovate the building into a more conventional theater space. The auditorium was lowered, balconies were added, and a proscenium arch was installed above the stage.
And this was called an opera house in those days because theater still had that kind of iffy reputation, but opera house sounded a little bit more impressive.
But it wasn't strictly opera.
It was never really opera at all. That was kind of the tradition at the time. People were railing against theater, so they thought, theater owners, that if they called the places opera houses, they could fool some of the people some of the time.
Kornhauser says many famous 19th and 20th century performers passed through the Fulton, including Mark Twain, Buffalo Bill Cody, and Wild Bill Hickok, Edwin Booth, Ethel Barrymore, and John Philip Sousa. The space went on to become a vaudeville venue, a movie house, and then a more traditional theater stage again, nearly closing its doors at different junctures, but always somehow surviving. While mindful of its history, managing director Aaron Young says today the company is committed to a contemporary mission.
We're not a museum. We honor what has been done in the past, but it's all about how do we move forward? How do we communicate with an audience now? How do we remain relevant in an era that, you know, has a lot of different options for people's leisure time? We no longer have a monopoly like, you know, we did back in the 1800s when the theater was built.
Remaining relevant to today's audiences, says Mark Robin, means paying close attention to the surrounding community.
You know, make sure that we're not moving so far towards, you know, the next rung of the ladder that we forget where we are to begin with. And that's going to be a really fun juggling act.
The Fulton Opera House is a larger-than-average theater. The horseshoe-shaped Italianate-style auditorium holds about 700 people. Aaron Young says keeping a facility of this size alive means being sensitive to popular demand.
We're more populist than a typical regional theater because we are so large we can't be a niche market. And so we tend to do things that will attract attention, but we'll do plays like Old Wicked Songs or Doubt or Pride's Crossing, things that are significant pieces of writing, particularly American drama, that need to be seen, even though we know that they're not going to attract the audiences that Fiddler on the Roof will attract.
The Fulton's new artistic director, Mark Robin, agrees that producing shows with a mass appeal is integral to the Fulton's success.
But I also don't want our entire goal to be about just putting on, you know, shows because they're going to sell. You know, I'd love to be developing new work here, as well as re-envisioning old work.
Though ambitious about the future, Robin says the state of today's economy forces the Fulton to be cautious.
So all the visions in the world mean nothing if we can't sort of turn this tide and turn this corner. So for the next year, possibly two, we're going to play it safer than we would like to eventually.
With Robin's long-term goal to build the Fulton's reputation as a leading regional theater in central Pennsylvania, the historic landmark will continue to be, as it has for more than 150 years, a place for people to gather, be entertained, and consider new ideas. An old architectural treasure and a new artistic director eager to take it into the 21st century, the Fulton story continues.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer, and that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.